Welcome to Exploration 1, Lecture 4, which partially has some bits of Module 4 in it, but it's primarily about subnetting. Now, this is one of the most challenging parts of Exploration, and whilst he's now very good at it, and I'll probably get into technical trouble for saying this, some of our students have found this a challenging journey. However, the rewards at the end of the journey is the ability to be able to subnet, and I can assure you that I spent a couple of hours on Skype to some of last year's students, assisting them with their subnet stuff and tidying out any confusion. So if anybody wants to dob themselves in for having trouble with subnetting, they can. You don't have to. But suffice it to say, it is a skill that once mastered is highly useful and lets you earn lots and lots of money. And after all, isn't that the point of it all? Mwahahaha. Okay? It's a key networking skill.
I'll put my hand up. I'm horrible at subnetting.
Alrighty. Now, is there anybody here who does not know what an IP address looks like? So does anybody know how we'd normally write an IP address? Would somebody like to try type an example of an IP address into chat? That is a good example of I'm going to give you the napkins and I'm going to eat my muffin later because I'm busy talking. So you take that. People who know me will assure themselves that Kerry being busy talking is not something that's somewhat unusual. Now, 192.168.1.1, 192.168.2.1, 192.73.86.4, these are all IP addresses. Can anybody apart from Brian and Pranav ineligible to answer the following question, and Chris, he's ineligible too. Tell me what an IP address does. What is the whole point of an IP address? Why would we even talk about these things? Or an IPv4 address, I should say. Go ahead, Aidan.
It identifies your computer on the network, whether it be the internet or the local router network. So, for example, if you're on a router, your internal IP address might be 192.168.1.3. But then, if you're on the actual internet, your router's IP might be 68.124.blah.blah.
All right. I'm gonna clarify. That's absolutely correct. I'll clarify a few points on that at the moment. Anybody got any questions so far? Okay. If you don't have any questions, please type no into chat. This will save me from pausing for 20 seconds while I wait for you all to respond. Okie dokies. So, an IP address uniquely identifies a computer on the internet. It is a 32-bit number. Now, I don't want to get into the binary stuff just yet. I'll give that another couple of minutes. But as we were talking about last week, in the OSI reference model, which has 7 layers, physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application. Okay, so that's physical, data link, network, transport, session, presentation, application. For some reason, I'm having trouble with that this morning. I mustn't have had my muffin yet. They are the 7 layers of the OSI reference model, and you can listen to the other bits of the course to tell yourself about the different layers of the OSI reference model. I will do a quick rundown now. It is the 7-layer model that we use to compare network protocols to other network protocols, and we can wander around like, you know, spider's nests of cable and say things like, "Oh, I think we're having an application layer problem." Or, "Gee, that seems to be a transport layer issue." And not only does it make us look really clever, provided we know what we're talking about, but it allows us to be able to pinpoint the problem in a complex system such as an internet work, and then be able to work on diagnosing the problems that we have on the network. I should mention that there is actually an eighth layer of the OSI reference model unofficially. It's called the bosone layer, and it refers to the loose nut sitting between the keyboard and the chair that can break everything regardless of how good the protocol design is. And that that bozo was also known as the user. So that's the unofficial eighth layer. So if you've got a layer eight problem, that's something you can also sometimes have to fix. Now, I'll quickly go through these. The physical layer determines itself with cables, voltages, all that sort of stuff. Voltages on a cable, the way we're going to send bits, whether we're going to use Manchester encoding, all that sort of stuff. The data link layer concerns itself with framing, so putting the data together into frames that can be sent across the network that have network or LAN specific addresses. We're dealing with things such as Ethernet, FDDI, all that sort of stuff. That's where your framing comes in. Now, can anybody tell me, and it's open to anybody who wants to be able to answer this one, what type of network address is used at the data link layer of the OSI reference model, or layer 2?
MAC.
MAC. Hey. Yes, it's a MAC address at layer 2, right? Okay. I'm sure there'll be trademark problems with that, but there it is. A MAC address is, and doesn't matter, Grace, you don't have to enjoy the jokes. You just have to sit there and groan. A MAC address is 48 bits long. It is 24 bits for the OUI, which is the Organizational Unique Identifier, and it is 24 bits for the actual host portion where that identifies a specific machine apart from the vendor ID. Now, has anybody here, apart from Pranav, played with Wireshark and T-Shark? Has anybody even heard of Wireshark and T-Shark?
I've played, but the parameters for the batch files baffle, make my head hurt at this point.
Well, it just so happens that next week is your lucky week, because I'll be going through how to construct filter expressions, how to use T-Shark, how to get verbose output, and how to get very brief output. And you don't want to use Pranav's batch file, necessarily.
How to get verbose output? Can't you just listen to the lecture and get verbose output? You get Kerry talking.
You'll keep.
Sorry. Sorry, I couldn't help it.
Ah, that's what they all say. Now, it just so happens that what you need to do with Wireshark and T-Shark, and I'll cover this next week with a demo, with like JAWS and everything, like, you know, Reed will help us out here, is you basically need to construct a filter expression. So, for example, you do T-Shark space dash F space quote port space 25 quote, and that will limit your capture traffic to only deal with port 25. Or you can go T-Shark space dash F space quote port space 25 space and space SRC space 192.168.6.4 quote, and that will limit your capture to stuff that is coming from that particular IP address. And this is actually covered on the Wireshark wiki, and it's also covered in the TCP dump man page. It's actually the same filter language that TCP dump uses. Now, we're not going to go heavily into that, but that is how you quieten the noise down so that you can then make sense of what's coming through. Otherwise, you can't see the forest for the trees. All right, but the reason I mentioned T-Shark and Wireshark is if you actually do a T-Shark dump, and you manage to go dash I to pick which interface and stuff, and you actually watch the packets, it will show you the source and destination MAC addresses, and it will show you the people who make them. So, for example, you will often see traffic from CompuLab to Asus Tech, or from Asus Tech to MSI Technologies, and that is showing you which devices are actually talking on your local area network. Can anybody tell me another technology that makes use of MAC addresses apart from Ethernet?
ISPs?
No.
Wi-Fi.
Wireless does. Yes, wireless has MAC addresses. What's another technology that does?
Bluetooth?
ARP.
Yes, Bluetooth. No, not ARP. ARP is a sub-protocol of TCP/IP, which we'll talk about in a minute. So Bluetooth uses MAC addresses. And you know how when you do that thing where you go search for Bluetooth devices and then it says, XYZ Braille keyboard, and you go, yeah, connect, and then it fails because you upgraded to the newest version of Keysoft. But up to that point, that friendly name is actually tied to a 48-bit MAC address. So what actually happens is you're actually connecting to device 00:C5:D4:A5:K, B9:47. But to actually show that to a user isn't very friendly. We'd rather see, Aiden's phone or Sean's Mac or whatever. So that's why they tie names to these MAC addresses, because it's theoretically more friendly for you to see the friendly name of a device than it is for you to actually see the actual MAC address that shows up. Has anybody been into their iThing under the settings about section, and it actually shows you your Bluetooth and your wireless MAC address? I don't know, has anybody been in there?
I know, yeah. On the Braille sensor, the about shows the same thing. I don't know about the Bluetooth one. It shows the LAN and the
it
wireless
does.
Ones.
It will show the Bluetooth to you, and if you go in and see how you're connected, if you're connected.
Oh, okay.
I believe.
Are they usually the same one?
No, absolutely not.
Two separate devices.
Every physical media has to have a different one. So Bluetooth has to have a different one, wireless has to have a different one, and your actual LAN card has to have a different one.
Oh, wow. So the little Bluetooth dongle thingy that I plug into my computer has a different MAC address for my Wi-Fi, which has a different MAC address for my Ethernet port.
Yep.
Right.
You'd want to hope so. Otherwise, if you had two network devices with the same MAC address, which can be done if you get those really cheap Ethernet cards from China that let you set the MAC address to anything you like, bad things TM happen. Okay? And what can actually happen is you get two devices showing up on the same MAC address, and then when the packets are sent over the Ethernet, there is no way easily for it to determine which machine it's actually sent to based on the MAC address, because two machines are now receiving the packets.
Can I interrupt with something? I think I saw speculation on one of the note-taker lists that they're actually possibly using the MAC address to license the GPS. I'm not sure if that's the case, but I think I saw that. You could certainly
possibly
do it that way if you really wanted
that
to.
That can certainly happen, yeah. Yeah, the
that's
MAC address.
That's how I do it.
Yeah, the MAC address is unique to a specific device, and given the fact that you're probably going to talk to the Bluetooth over, going to talk to the GPS over Bluetooth, it would make sense that you license the GPS add-on.
This thing has three MAC addresses, so they could use any of them.
Well, no, you'd want to use the one for the Bluetooth if you were doing GPS, because you could turn your wireless and your Ethernet off, and then those MAC addresses wouldn't then make any sense, would they? Because the devices are actually disabled in the hard.
I think they were just saying, hey, if your device has this MAC address, which we know about, then it'll work. Then our program will actually run. I think.
Well,
the other thing that Tim's was using MAC address to license their.
Yeah, that can certainly happen. The other thing you can also find is that on certain note takers and stuff, because there are bugs in the underlying Bluetooth stacks, they will actually only allow a subset of GPS units to work. Trekker, anybody? And what it actually does is it uses the unique organizational unique identifier to actually show what vendors of GPS they're going to work with. So this will work with the iBlue 737, the 747, and stuff. Well, kind of. But then again, you'd rather have your GPS work than buying an I'm Lost 796 and find that it doesn't actually work with Trekker and you're still lost.
Okay, I guess that makes sense.
Alrighty, any questions about MAC addresses? Alright, if you are sitting in front of a Windows box or you have a Mac in front of you, open up a command prompt / Mac terminal thing, please. Okay, so however you do that, I'm going to go Windows R and I'm going to type in CMD. See, how practical is this lecture going to be? And you should be sitting at a command prompt. Well, at least your computer should be. You might not actually be. So let me know when everybody is ready with their command prompt. This command is non-destructive, I assure you, or I'd be in big trouble.
Hurry up, carry this greater than symbol I'm sitting on is really uncomfortable.
Ready. I'm sitting on
Well, it's actually a crocodile facing to the left, Aiden, and it's going to bite you soon.
It's going to eat my username.
Alrighty. C:\Documents\Settings\Kerry right angle bracket. Here we go. Now, we want to do... Does anybody remember Deck Talk and its right angle bracket?
No.
Anyone old enough to remember the right angle
bracket? Yeah, it's curly bracket, isn't it?
No, it was a greater than. It was a right-angle bracket. It was actually... It's also known as a chevron prompt, if you're in digital Unix world and deck stuff. They call it a chevron.
Jaws used to say notification chevron. I guess chevron, that was a greater than thingy. Because it makes the system tray show
NVDA
more stuff.
NVDA says that.
That must be an XP thing, because I remember that.
I'm not sure what the actual technical definition of a chevron is, but I always thought it was a cool word. I must take the psychic chevron, you know, and...
I thought it was some kind of freaking gas station or car.
Yeah, that's kind of what I thought, too.
Yeah, isn't it a car?
I have no idea, but...
I think there is a gas
station. It probably is. Okay, but now that we are sitting on the greater than, which is quite uncomfortable, if you can type ARP space minus A. Now, ARP, as Chris has pointed out, stands for address... Minus A for alpha, apple, okay. Angry, anxious, agreeable, awful. Okay?
Awesome.
A.
Yes.
Awesome! Yeah, A for awesome.
Apple pie.
I would just like to point out here that just because apple pie is full of apples, it is not healthy, all right? It's a sugar in it. What you are going to see is a...
Online.
What does yours say?
So who knows?
What does yours say? Does it say command not found?
Oh, wait, hang on, I know why. You have to close Clisk first. Hello.
That helps.
Cannot believe I just did.
Who's yours?
Oh, there we go, that's better.
Huh? Sorry, you weren't here.
Yeah, he was. He said, that's better.
No, I said, who did you almost call?
I didn't almost call anybody, I just tried to... No, I typed ARP and it said error to unknown command, and then it said Clisk after it, and then I'm like, oh, duh.
Once he called terminal, though.
I did! And left a message for the terminal.
That's good. Yeah, mine shows interface and 192.168.1.something.
Yeah, mine does too, it shows all my interfaces.
And then it says 2.0x3.
Yeah, the 0x3 is the interface number, and then it's got 00:... Right? It shows the IP address to MAC address mapping. So when you're actually on an Ethernet, each device that is directly connected to your Ethernet, okay, has a unique MAC address. And you have to imagine me thumping the table as I say, a MAC address is only used inside the local Ethernet. Okay, this is really important. You do not send your MAC address over the internet. Once your packets go through a router, the MAC addresses are stripped off them, and they are MAC addressless, and they go off on their merry way across the internet. So MAC addresses are only relevant on your local network, with underlines and exclamation marks and stuff.
I'm looking at here.
So the ARP table contains a mapping between any of the IP addresses your machine has recently spoken to on the local network and any of the hardware addresses of those devices. So for example, mine's got 192.168.168.100.11 00:A6:31:D9:14. That is the MAC address of our router. So it's basically shown that I have spoken to my default gateway recently because I'm on Ventrilo and I'm talking to you guys, and that has a MAC address of whatever that thing is. So that is the MAC address of my router.
I also sometimes it says at incomplete and then some stuff.
That's because whatever machine you were talking to has been off the network long enough so that your machine has been unable to talk to it. So say, for example, somebody had a machine turned on and they've turned it off. It means that the ARP resolution mechanism has now lost the IP address to that machine and would have to re-query it.
Okay.
Well, okay, going back to MAC addresses being on the local network, whenever the reason I mentioned the ISP was every time with TELUS, every time I have to get a new router or something, I have to reclone its MAC address, or I plug my computer into TELUS. TELUS only allows two MAC addresses registered with its connection. So I guess then all the ways in which I broadcast my MAC address are actually broadcasting the router's MAC address, so not my individual one then.
Well, there is actually, when you're actually on cable Ethernet or cable internet or whatever, there is the concept of a MAC address on the cable network, and that MAC address is an ISP, is on the ISP's network. It's not actually on yours, it's actually on the ISP's network. Now, what you then need to do is you then need to either register the MAC address that's going on with the ISP so that it will let you on, or you need to clone the MAC address of a recognized device. Now, if ever you've seen one of those routers that's running Tomato or whatever firmware, often when users first connect onto their ISP, they connect on with their computer, and the ISP then, you know, registers their computer's MAC address, and you get one of those dodgy single port cable modem horror things, not always made by Two Wire. And then you go, I just got myself a new router, and you want to then take the router online. If you tell the router to clone your PC's MAC address and then go onto the cable network, your router can then share out your cable connection to all of the PCs behind the router, and that's what cloning MAC address is used
for. That's cool.
So that you can have the same address and still stick multiple PCs on the behind the router in possible violation of the terms of service of your internet service provider, but hopefully in 2010 not.
But your modem itself and your router are going to have their own MAC addresses too, so that's why it was confusing in that scenario.
What you can actually do is you can clone the what a lot of people do is they clone the MAC address of their cable modem into their router so that it shows as having they clone the address of their PC, which is registered, into the modem, which then clones it into the same MAC address so that the ISP sees the MAC address that it's expecting to see.
And if you have an Apple AirPort Express, you may not be able to clone a MAC address.
Yes, if you have an Apple anything, you might not be able to do all sorts of things because it's an Apple thing and they've said you can't. But yes, there are certain routers that will not clone MAC addresses and will not do these things for you because the makers have decided that that's not something they want you doing.
And if that's the case, then any PC that connects to that router will be displaying its own MAC address?
Well, they will anyway, but obviously if you can't clone the MAC address, you can't connect that AirPort onto the cable network without re-registering the MAC address of the AirPort with your ISP. Alrighty, any questions about that stuff so far?
No.
Where's the ARP table kept?
The ARP table is kept in volatile memory of any device participating on an Ethernet and TCP/IP network.
So, in my local network, if I've got two PCs on, they both have an ARP table, or is it the router that has the ARP table?
All of them have an ARP table. The router has an ARP table, the PC1 has an ARP table, and PC2 has an ARP table. And in fact, if PC1 has only ever spoken to the router, it will only have the router in its ARP table. However, if PC2 has spoken to PC1 and the router, it will have PC1 and the router in its ARP table. And yes, this comes up in your final exam for exploration. If you were doing exploration, for anybody who's doing exploration.
That actually makes some sense.
Is that what they call the leasing and the releasing?
No, the leasing and releasing and stuff is actually Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol, or Dynamic Host Control Protocol, I think it actually technically stands for. It depends on who you talk to. But basically what happens is when you request a lease, you actually provide your MAC address, and the DHCP server ties your MAC address to the IP address that it is leasing to you. So your MAC address is tied to 192.168.1.6, and because those two things are tied together, you can then the router then knows, you know, what IP address you're going to have. When you release that address, you actually say, I no longer want to use 192.168.1.6, and the DHCP server says, okay, I'm clearing the lease for MAC address, yada, 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 and you are then released. When you renew, you then go back and request based on your MAC address. And what actually happens with DHCP is, first of all, there is a discover phase that says, discover from blah, and that gets broadcast to everywhere. The DHCP says, I'll offer you this IP address. Your machine says, I request this IP address, and then the DHCP server says, I acknowledge that you have requested this IP address, and that's when the lease goes into the database. And there will actually be an exercise where you get to see, well, if you're doing exploration, there will be an exercise where you actually get to see this happen with Wireshark. I have designs and plans so that you guys can see these requests and releases and renews and stuff with T-Shark. And yes, T-Shark runs on a Mac. Obviously, if you're working on a cable network and you're releasing and renewing your IP address to try and get connectivity to your ISP, it is possible for some reason that your router has lost its idea of what IP address it should have, or the ISP is out of sync with what IP address you should have. So basically it releases and renews it to attempt to get you an IP address so that you can then talk on the internet again. That's why you do all that stuff. Alright, the other command you want to run if you're under Windows is ipconfig, and if you are under a Mac, you want to run if, as in India Foxtrot config. So if we can run that command...
I think
we've
got ipconfig so that it works too. I think they've actually...
Oh wow, did they?
...put it so that that works. I think they did. Let me see.
Hello, suppose I get that it's not recognized as an internal or external command.
You want ipconfig, India Papa config.
And what am I doing with it?
Without a space?
No space.
Okay, that was a problem.
I think they've got one, but it doesn't quite do the same thing.
Alrighty, so this command basically shows you the interfaces or the physical, like, networky cardy things and which IP addresses and subnet masks and gateways and stuff are assigned to those address, are those adapters. And hopefully by the time I'm finished the lecture today, if I get far enough in this, we will be able to show you how this all works and how those funky numbers work. And if by the time you have finished my networking course, if you're doing my networking course, and I ever catch you just saying, I'll just put in 255.255.255.0 without any idea of what that means, I will be very upset.
Whoa, ifconfig has just generated a huge amount of stuff on
You
Mac.
Can actually cut it down for you, Sean, by going ifconfig space en0, which will give you the primary Ethernet only.
EN0?
Yeah, that's what they call them on the Mac. EN for Ethernet. I don't know. They're BSD. We just let them do that, okay? Under Linux, it's ETH0, and you've got WLAN0, and you've got other things. But on the Mac, it happens to be EN0. I can't remember what they call the wireless LAN. I think it's WL0, but don't quote me on that.
Okay, I have config space... I'm sorry.
Echo November 0.
Is it just the space? Okay. And then EN. Alright, I thought there was another character before the... Oh, that's better. Now it works.
Alrighty, so these IP addresses are written in what we call dotted decimal form. Also known as dotted quad notation. They are four numbers separated by a full stop. A dot. A spot. Whatever you want to call it. 192.168.1.2. Okay? They're separated by dots. The actual internal representation of an IP address is actually a 32-bit number. Big number. And I'll talk about that later. So you've got an IP address of 1,647,836,409. Yeah, I can remember that. In fact, I've already forgotten it. Which is why we break it down into the four numbers separated by the full stops to make it easier for humans to understand them and easier for humans to remember what they are and see what they're set to. Alrighty. Now, we're going to do a little bit of revision of number systems, because without this revision of number systems, I'm not going to be able to teach you binary, and without binary, you're going to have a little bit of trouble with subnetting. So here comes the My Brain Hurts section of the lecture. Everybody would understand that when you count, normally in English, you use 10 symbols, the symbols 0 to 9. Okay? So what we do when we count is we go 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, dot, 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 20, 21. Everybody happy with that? I don't think anybody's going to argue with that, but there might be one person. Everybody happy with that's how we count?
I should hope so.
All right, but one of the things you've got to understand is that this 10, 11, 12, 13 stuff are just weird numbers for 1-1, 1-2, 1-3, 1-4, 1-5, 1-6, 1-7, 1-8, 1-9, 2-0. Can anybody tell me what 12 or 1-2 actually means?
Is it 10 plus 2?
One lot of 10 plus lots of 1.
Oh, yeah.
Anybody here played with Cuisenaire and air rods?
Long time ago. I think I remember this.
And everybody's heard that, you know, 4 and 20 blackbirds baked in a pie sort of thing, okay? It's a different way of how you, you know, look at numbers. And I think I'd have dropped my sensitivity. Am I cutting out? I think my sensitivity is slightly...
Yeah, I think you are.
Yeah, okay, right, I thought so.
I think he is.
Okay, check 2127. Did you get the check? Did you get... Okay, that's working. All right. So, everybody would be happy to say that 346 is 3 lots of 100 plus 4 lots of 10 plus 6 lots of 1. 346 is 3 lots of 100 plus 4 lots of 10 plus 6 lots of 1. Everybody happy with that concept?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now we get to be a bit confusing. Can anybody tell me, and Pranav and Brian are... exempt, because I told them last year. Can anybody tell me what anything raised to the power 0 is equal to? 6 to the power of 0, 40 squillion to the power of 0, except for 0 to the power of 0. But anything above 0 to the power of 0? No?
It's 1, isn't it, actually?
It's 1. And I can prove that very quickly, just in case somebody wants to know how it works. When you have... when you're dividing two indices or multiplying two indices together, you actually add and subtract the indexes. Okay, so if we say 8 is 2 to the power of 3, if we say 2 to the power of 3 divided by 2 to the power of 3, or 8 divided by 8, because we're doing a division, we subtract the indices, so 3 minus 3 is 0, which will give us 2 to the power of 0. 8 divided by 8 is equal to 1. Therefore, 2 to the power of 0 equals 1. And yes, I'll write it down somewhere between now and the end of the course so that you guys get to see that. But that's why anything to the power of 0 is actually equal to 1.
Or you can just take it as the fact that anything to the power of 0 is 1 and not worry about why, which is what I do.
Except for 0 to the power of 0, which is actually 0.
Except for the...
Alright. Now, the reason I mention this is because when we look at the number 15, which is 1 lot of 10 plus 5 lots of 1, we're all happy with that, The five lots of one is actually expressed as 5 × 10⁻⁰. So 15 can actually be written as 5 × 10⁻⁰ plus 1 × 10⁻⁰. 10⁻⁰ being 10, 5 × 10⁻⁰ being 5, that gives us our number 15. Anybody got any questions on that or want clarification? I realize I may have gone through that a bit fast. And yes, this is actually written in the extras section on the website, so that you can go and read it all. Under exploration, there's actually a thing called extras, and I actually write out a whole lot of conversion examples.
Yeah, you need but to run through that.
All right, the number 15 is 1 lot of 10 plus 5 lots of 1. We're all clear with that?
Yeah, I got that part.
10 can be written as 10 to the power of 1. Everybody happy with that?
Yep.
I guess it can.
10 to the power of 2 is equal to 100, because 10 times 10 is 100. So 100 can be written as 10 to the power of 2. 1,000, 10 times 10 times 10, is written as 10 to the power of 3. Everybody happy with that? Well, as happy as they're ever going to be.
Yeah.
10 to the power of 6 is 1,000,000. 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 times 10 is 1,000,000. Take my word for it, it is. Alrighty. Now, so if we have 10 to the power of 1, which is our lots of 10s, or let's take the number 35, because that might be a better example. 35 is 3 times 10 to the power of 1 plus 5 times 10 to the power 0, because we need 5 lots of 1. So 3 times 10 to the power of 1 plus 5 times 10 to the power of 0 is actually going to give us 35.
If you say so.
I do, and it's true.
Okay.
Look, you just wander around every day, sort of, and somebody goes, that'll be $37.51, and you go, ah, so that's 3 times 10 to the power of 1 plus 7 times 10 to the power of 0 plus 5 times 10 to the power of minus 1 plus 7 times 10 to the power of minus 2, no problem. Okay, you don't usually say that, okay, because we don't tend to go into that level of detail. But the fact is that our entire number system is based on these powers. It's based on raising a base to a power to give you a particular number. So 10 to the power of 6 is 1,000,000. Yeah, 10 to the power of 9 is 1,000,000,000. Or 10 to the power of 12 is 1,000,000,000 if you're over in Britain, because they've got to have bigger billions than you. All those sorts of things. But it's very important to understand that our number system is based on powers. And if it wasn't, you couldn't do all the addition and subtraction and stuff that you do to work things out, even if the calculator is doing it for you. So, the point of this is that, I don't know whether anybody's old enough to... Is anybody old enough here to have used log tables?
Yeah, I did in the school.
Okay. Basically, a log table would allow you to multiply 6,708 by 9,704, and it would allow you to do it easily. And basically, what you did was you took the log of those two numbers, and then you added them up, and then you used your anti-log table to actually dereference what the logarithm was, and that was how we added things up quickly before we had calculators. But we're not going to cover that any further in this course, but that's where this power stuff comes in. Because you can actually take the two indexes and add them together, and you used a common base, you can actually then perform an anti-log, which will then give you the answer to your question. Aren't we happy that we've got calculators? Although, if you're vision impaired, and I don't know whether this has changed in the last 20 years, but good luck finding a non-programmable calculator that has statistics functions and a fraction button to be used in your high school exams.
No, I don't think that's changed.
There's one actually, that I know of.
Oh, okay, there is one now, is there?
Yeah, I forget where we even get it from, but there is actually a speaking scientific calculator.
Is it the TI-34 or TI-36 from Orion? It's one of those two.
Yeah, one of them.
Okay, I have the 34.
Yeah, no, it's a 36, I think. I actually had a Braille one, which was a standard HP programmable calculator mounted on this weird thingy that had 8 Braille cells.
Wow.
I saw one of those. They were cool.
My calculator never worked, so...
Oh, that's always unfortunate. All right. Now, the reason I talk about this 10 stuff is because when I go to teach you binary, can anybody... Actually, before I continue, can anybody give me an idea as to why we count in base 10? Why is 10 so cool? And it's a pretty simple reason. No.
We have 10 digits on our hand.
We do. If you look at your fingers and thumbs, there's 10 of them. And then if you want to count to 20, you can take your shoes off and you've got 10 on your feet. 10, 10, 10. Okay? That's why everybody likes 10 so much. When some primate was plunking through the jungle and sort of, you know, plunked down on a log and looked at what was on the end of his hands while he was figuring out how to like walk upright and stuff, he noticed that there were 10 things sticking out of the end of them, and that's why we count in base 10. Alrighty. Now, apart from the fact that not everybody's happy with the fact that that's how the bases work and it's written up in the text file, and I'll talk to them individually later if they don't sort of melt down first. Computers are a bank of logic switches, and the entire inside of a computer is thousands and thousands of on-off switches. There's a not very PC joke that we toss around the engineering circles that says it wasn't until women got into computers that we discovered a maybe gate. Until then we had yes and no. But we won't dwell on that. If you have on and off switches, the switch can either be on or off. It can either be a 1 or a 0, a yes or a no. You can either have something or you don't. And these switches, thousands and thousands and thousands of them, or these gates inside, you know, microprocessors and stuff, make up the entire innards of the computer. So when computers use numbers and things, they use this funny thing called a binary system. Now, a light switch is a good example of a bit. It's either on or it's off. And when it is on, the circuit is closed and the light goes on. When it is off, the circuit is open and the light goes out. Owners of iThings, grab yourself a copy of Light Detector for 99 cents. It uses the camera on the back of your iThing, assuming that it has one, and tells you whether the lights and stuff are on or not. Very cool.
Yay! I'm going to do that.
It can also be used to tell you whether your monitors are on, and all those sorts of things. Yeah. Okay. Now. Has anybody who isn't sort of an old schooler, has anybody ever heard of a thing called ASCII, the American Standard Code for Information Interchange?
Yeah.
When you actually press keys on your computer keyboard, they are actually converted into a number. Well, technically they're actually converted into what we call a scan code, and each time you press a key there is a make scan code and there is a break scan code, which means that when you actually push down a key it generates one number, and then when you let it go it generates another number, which is why you can use some keyboards for braille input, because you can hold down these keys and it can tell which keys are held down and which keys are not, and you can braille like a Perkins brailler onto on, say, for example, using SDF and JKL. Just as a minor aside, are we still having as many problems getting keyboards that will allow us to do that in 2010 that will actually allow you to hold down multiple yes. buttons, or have they resolved that?
Yeah, I think so.
No, they're actually, I think, getting harder to get. Keyboards that will do the 6-key entry, for example, in Duxbury are getting pretty hard to find.
Because the cheap ones are getting rid of key rollover, which makes that happen, and Duxbury explains that on their website pretty well, and even has you a little thing to help you find a test you can do to find one. They document that pretty clearly.
We actually get in contact with one of the key manufacturers, and I think they got in touch with about 5 manufacturers, and one manufacturer was nice enough to actually ask them why they wanted this, and actually did suggest a model of their keyboard that would actually do it. Alright, but what actually happens is you press a make key and you press a break key, and if you happen to be like numerically minded, the make scan code is, say, 3A in hexadecimal, and then the break scan code is actually AA, because it actually sets the high bit on the byte to show that that's the break scan code. And that allows you to do things like control Windows up arrow, because the operating system actually sees the fact that you've held down control, you've held down Windows, it's seen the make codes for those, it then sees the up arrow, it then sees you not, you know, release the rest of those keys, and then those keys go away. But unfortunately, the rollover support only works on the modifier keys such as control, alt, shift, and Windows and stuff. So that's a little aside. But when you actually type things into a document, they're converted into numbers. So for example, a capital A is 65, a capital B is 66, a capital C is 67, a lowercase a is 97, a lowercase b is 98, and a lowercase c is 9. And that is called the American Standard Code for Information Interchange. And then America discovered that there were people who spoke other languages, which was a bit of a shock for them. And we came out with Unicode, which is now a 2-byte or sometimes 4-byte representation of that code. And it allows you to have all of those funny foreign characters and stuff. And in fact, if you use Notepad, I believe it does Unicode, because you can actually have bullets in Windows 7 version of Notepad, which is Unicode 8226, according to Jaws. Well, this is an interesting point, actually. If you actually look at regular Braille, I'm talking about the 6-dot section, not the beefed-up 12-dot section, beefed-up 8-dot section, you can actually consider Braille as a rudimentary binary system, because dot 1 will be your least significant bit and dot 6 will be your most significant bit. So if you want to put the character E down, you will have to have bits 1 and bits 5 turned on.
What I just remembered is that if you actually have a way, and my friend has done this, if you are capable of actually entering the Braille Unicode characters, the Mac will actually tell you what dot characters they represent if you actually use the current character commands, because I've done it, which is really weird.
But then again, I don't believe BRF actually does that anyway, so I'd
say... No, it doesn't, but it was...
So it's... Okie dokies. Now, the problem that we now get to with computers is if a computer needs to represent the number 7, the only thing a computer has to represent numbers is it has ons and offs. It has yeses and nos. It has whatever, however you want to look at it. So instead of using 10 to the power of everything, like I spoke earlier, we actually use 2 to the power. This is called binary, as in B-I, as in bicycle, as in bipedal, as in bi. Binary. So the number system has two symbols. It has a 0 and it has a 1. Now, for a virtual lollipop, can anybody tell me what is 2 to the power of 0?
What?
It is 1. I'm going to turn my sensitivity up a little bit because it's triggering a bit too much. It's a... Okay, can anybody tell me what 2 to the power of 1 is?
2. That's right. 2's right. Gary can't talk at the moment. He's fixing it. So you can say all the nasty things you want about him.
Yes, and then I will...
There you go. Now you can respond.
So 2 to the power of 1 is 2. Okay? Everybody happy with that? 2 to the power of 0 is 1. We'll just take it to red as to anything to the power of 0 is 1. 2 to the power of 1 is 2, because 1 lot of 2 is 2. Everybody cool with that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, to represent 3, we need to have 1 lot of 2 to the power of 0, which is a 1, and 1 lot of 2 to the power of 1, which is 2. 2 plus 1 equals 3. Therefore, we represent 3 in binary as 1, 1.
Why 1, 1 again? I know you said it, but I need you to say it again.
1, 1 being 1 lot of 2, or 1 lot of 2 to the power of 1, plus 1 lot of 2 to the power of 0, is 2 plus 1 equals 3. There are plenty of third-party calculators that you type in a decimal number and you press the button and it converts it to binary, and you'll never learn anything, which is why we actually go through this, because when you actually start looking at subnetting, it's very important to understand how the bits actually fall and how the bits work. And yes, you can get a subnet calculator, but you probably won't be a revered network technician if you don't understand how these boundaries fall. If you're never going to be a network technician, that in itself isn't a problem, but it also enhances the understanding of how this stuff actually functions. Now, say for example, we have the number 4. Would we all agree that the number 4 can be represented as 2 to the power of 2?
Yeah.
Therefore, to write 4 in binary, we would write 1, 0, 0. 1 lot of 2 to the power of 2 plus 0 lots of 2 to the power of 1 plus 0 lots of 2 to the power of 0. 1, 0, 0 is 4. So does anybody know how we'd write the number 5?
1001.
1001.
5 would only be 101.
That's the root 101.
No, somebody actually said 1001.
So did Chris, and so did someone else. I'm not going to dob in. 101 is 1 lot of 2 to the power of 2 plus 0 lots of 2 to the power of 1 plus 1 lot of 2 to the power of 0 is 4 plus 1 equals 5. I must stress that there are actually examples written out on QCAT.org under exploration, under the extra labs binary exercise 2010, and binary subnet example, and subnet example, and yet another subnet example, and these are all written out so you can go down line by line, preferably with a braille display. But if you don't have a braille display, you go down without a braille display. Okay. Now, it goes... So what you basically need when you are converting binary to decimal and decimal to binary, if you're going to do it without the calculator, is a table of powers of 2. Has anybody apart from Sean heard the Inchworm song? 1 and 1 is 2, 2 and 2 is 4, 4 and 4 is 8, 8 and 8 is 16, 16 and 16 is 32. Inchworm. I think Anne Murray did a version of it, actually. It's got to be on YouTube. So has anybody else heard the Inchworm song before? Or is it just... Yeah.
Yes, I did.
You've been in my lecture before.
No, I actually had to try and sing a version of it for a recording, but it didn't get put on the recording, thank goodness, because it was...
Okie dokie. My jaws just decided that it's not talking all sorts of interesting things, so we'll just carry on. Okay. So, what you find about the powers of two is that if you look at the powers of two, they double. So, you get 0, and then you get 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, 512, 102, 4, 2048, 4096, 8192, etc., etc., etc. Can anybody tell me what is another branch of science that we see this doubling phenomenon?
I remember my powers of two from algebra.
I'll give you a clue. It's Green and Wiggles.
Biology?
Yeah, cell division. When the cells divide, you get one cell divides into two, and then two cells divide into four, and four cells divide into eight, or they make eight. And you think about this, you start off with a little bit of a sore throat, and then it gets really bad, and you've got lots and lots and lots of little sore throat things running around, and they've actually multiplied due to cell division, and there's like thousands and thousands of them, until you then take your antibiotics, which kills them all off, and you can talk again. So cell division is where we look at this doubling, this exponential doubling of things to give you like the powers of two and stuff.
Is anyone else's throat starting to hurt now?
Yes, mitosis, I believe it's called. And, yeah, that's a biology thing and that sort of thing. No, just you, Chris. It's psychosomatic. Your throat is hurting incredibly. It's hurting. Okay. Now, you...
Actually, it's because I've got tonsillitis, but... I'll...
I know, and you can't eat ice cream. You can actually get the dairy-free ice cream. Alrighty.
Like, I get soy now, ice cream, but it tastes evil and it's expensive.
I think you can just crunch up bits of ice cube too. But anyway, our goal is not to cure Chris's tonsillitis. Our idea is to actually talk about subnetting. Now, we know that... So to actually convert from binary to decimal and decimal to binary, which... I am going to go into more fully in a future lecture because I think we've probably done enough of the mathy stuff. You actually need to figure out, if you're converting from decimal to binary, you need to find out which powers of two add up to make the number that you're working with. So say, for example, we're converting 47. We need to find out which powers of two you add together to get 47, and there is only one combination of them. And then when we actually write the binary number down, we set the bits that are the powers of 2, we actually set those to 1. So in our example of 47, we say, well, 47, 32 is a power of 2 that we can subtract from 47, so we put down a 1. We then can't subtract 16 from what's left because we've only got 42. We've only got 15 left. So we can't subtract 16, but we can subtract 8. So we put a 1, so we've got 101. We can subtract a 4, so we put 1011. We can subtract a 2, which is 10111. And we can subtract a 1, which is 101111, which is 47 in binary. I think I might have one too many bits. But that is the essential conversion process. If you do not have a pegboard, there are pictures of the pegboard up on the website. And we can't send you one because it's made of wood. And the customs people don't like us. So if you can by any chance get somebody to make you a pegboard with a drill and some bits of dowel, you will find this binary infinitely easier. the noise of grace goes down by an order of magnitude when you tell it to do binary and put a pegboard in front of it.
Yeah, that's basically it. And if you guys are going to do a lot of subnetting, you should have someone build you one.
Which is what I just said, except Grace was too busy arrowing down through something, so she didn't catch that.
It might be cool to have my dad build me one just to see what they actually look like, because I've been hearing about them and hearing about them and hearing about them.
They are a fairly good study aid, because they let you see the binary and how the ones and zeros go in. And then if you want the like pegboard with trainer wheels, you can actually put in Braille labels underneath the different holes, you can actually put the dymo stuff that says 1, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, so you've got all of the powers of 2 under your fingertips, and you can see what they are without having to remember them.
I can probably at least remember.
Are the dimensions for the pegboard on the site, Gary?
I believe they are.
I've only seen the pictures, and I don't even remember where the pictures were.
They're under general instructions, and then networking. And there's actually pictures of how the pegboard is set to make up. Basically, it's got to be big enough to allow you to put 32 bits of quarter-inch dowel in with a little bit of gap between each dowel. So if measurements are generally a problem, we will actually get the measurements for the pitches in there, and you'll be able to find out how big to actually make it. But it's basically one bit of MDF or something, a nice thick bit of board that somebody drills 96 holes in with a drill, and then you just get a bit of dowel, quarter-inch dowel, and chop it into, say, half-inch, three-quarter-inch lengths, and then you use those bits of dowel to actually stick in the holes as your pegs. So it's minorly time-consuming to make up, but it's certainly worth the effort if you want to really get a graphical, I am a graphical person, show me pegboard stuff thing. And you actually put a line. Yeah, you can use a Braille chessboard as well. That would help a lot too, because a chessboard is 8x8.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering about, because I have one of those.
Oh, that'd work well. You won't have the lines, but that's okay.
You'd have to actually
Braille
do... No,
and Braille chessboards. One's raised, yeah, you'd have and to one's actually... not.
Yeah, that won't actually help you in this, but what you will be able to do is you'll be able to have... See, on the actual full-size pegboard, you can have 32 running across, all the way across from left to right. You would actually have to use four rows of the chessboard to do that. Or you could do the binary vertical and use the four rows from left to right. That would be another way of doing it. But whatever works. But yeah, that would be a good start.
You could also use a spreadsheet, but that's not for everyone. But that is the other way you can get the spacing right.
And Pranav, being Mr. Spreadsheet himself, has a ripper little spreadsheet that he whipped up last semester that allowed him to do his subnetting and work out these different things in such a way to actually get the bits put down and stuff. Okay, but what does binary have to do with subnetting, I hear you ask? When we look at the internet, we know that an IP address is consisting of four numbers, four bytes, four octets, four lots of 8 bits, and it's a 32-bit number that says this is my IP address. So if we take the IP address 192.168.1.1 and we actually converted that to binary, well, we could, but I don't know whether we actually want to sit down and... Well, I suppose we could. 192 is 128 plus 64, so you've got 11000000 and 6 zeros in your first byte. 168 would be 128 plus... Give me a calculator. Oh, I can't actually pull up the calculator because my machine's gone la-la. 168. So you've 168. You've got 128, and you've got 38, 40, 58.
Whoever was speaking was really quiet. Yeah,
you got 40. So you've got 128. You've got 32, and you've got 8. So Grace is actually putting in the pegs for the She's actually putting in the pegs for the 128, she's putting in the peg for the 32, and she's putting in the peg for the 8. And she's doing it, and I'm just going to fill here for a moment because she's not
and
going.
And what I've got, I'm ready. What I've got here is 10101000.
Now, obviously, you'd need a bit more practice to be able to do that binary conversion as quickly as we have. And then you've got 1.1, which is obviously a peg in the right-hand section of the last 2 8 rows on the pegboard. So can people, even if they don't understand the entire conversion process, can people at least understand that given these combinations of the power of 2 allows us to represent any positive integer in decimal based on the combination of the powers?
Yes, yeah, I can do that in theory.
You'd probably need a couple of beers, though, and then you might be able to do it in practice.
Alcohol lubricates my brain.
We know. Seriously, he does much better under Linux command prompt once he's had a few. There is a point of diminishing returns, however, but if you get it between those 2 points, he's quite the Linux admin. Now, if you look at any router or PC or whatever, has anybody ever seen 192.168.1.2 netmask 255.255.255.0? Anybody seen that?
Yeah.
Think so, once or twice.
Think so.
What that technically means without doing the binary conversion and stuff is that the left-hand 3 bytes, 255.255.255, tell you which network the machine is on. And then the right-hand byte, which is 0, tells you that there is one byte left for the actual identifier for the different machines that you've got. So 192.168.1.2 with a subnet mask of 255.255.255.0 is on network 192.168.1, and it is host number 2. Let me see if I can type that into chat. My computer doesn't want to let me type.
I don't know, maybe you're typing that in the wrong window and you're sending that to someone on MSN.
No, just his computer's just clagging up and being old.
No, my computer's done all sorts of weird stuff, so I'm just sort of hoping that it's recording, because otherwise I'm going to be very sad.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's recording too, because I didn't do a backup or anything.
Oh god, I hope it's recording. Oh yes, it's recording. Okay, good.
Yay.
Yeah, so you're writing that down, Grace. You're writing 192.168. It's host number 2 on the 192.168.1 network. Yeah, and it's host 2. Host 2. Okay, so if we've got an IP address of 192.168. Grace's is being weird too, I don't know why. It is host number 2 on the 192.168.1 network. So if we had an IP address of 192.168.1.86, that would be host 86 on the 192.168.1 network. If we had 192.168.1.1, that would be host 1 on the 192.168.1 network. Everybody kind of cool with that? There we go. Everybody see that?
Yep. And it cut off.
No, it didn't. It actually put the whole lot there.
No, it came all the way through, yeah.
It said it all to me.
Oh, there it went.
You haven't got some horrendous flash-based thing open in the background eating your processor time, have you?
God, no. Nothing's open.
Alrighty. So, if we look at the subnet mask and we have 255.255.255.0, in simple terms it says we have 3 bytes for the network identifier and we have 1 byte for the host identifier. Now, if we have an IP address of 192.168.1.1 with a subnet mask of 255.255.0.0, that is actually host 1.1 on the 192.168 network.
That kind of makes sense, yeah.
Can we see that the number of 255s tells you how many numbers are part of the network and how many numbers are part of the host. If there are three lots of 255, we have 3 bytes for the network portion. If there are 2 lots of 255, we have 2 bytes for the network portion. If we have 1 lot of 255, there is 1 byte for the network portion. So, if we have 10.5.6.7, and we have a subnet mask of 255.0.0.0, we actually have host 5.6.7 on the 10 network. If you have, there's a very good reason. If you have 10.5.6.7 with a subnet mask of 255.0.0.0, so you have 10.5.6.7 with a subnet mask of 255.0.0.0. How many 255s do we have?
One.
How many bytes are part of the network portion?
One.
That's correct. There's one 255, therefore 1 byte is part of the network portion. What is the left-hand byte in that 10.5.6.7?
That's the host portion.
No.
Network portion. I just screwed it up. I knew what I was thinking, but I didn't say it correctly.
So, if we have 1 byte as part of the network portion, and the first byte of that IP address is a 10, then we are talking about the 10 network. The last 3 bytes of the address, 5.6.7, then refer to the particular host on that 10 network. Now, Brian has raised an interesting question. He has said, why would we want to do that? Depending on how many machines we have on a particular TCP/IP network, we need to have a different number of hosts. So if we actually look at a byte, sorry to keep you up, Grace. If we actually look at a byte, we know that the range of a byte is 0 to 255. That's just something we know because there are 8 bits, and if we look at 1111111, it is 128 plus 64 plus 32 plus 16 plus 8 plus 4 plus 2 plus 1. Now, I don't expect anybody to know that until they've actually looked at the binary conversion charts and examples and stuff. So on a network that has 1 byte as part of its host portion, we can have a maximum of 254 hosts, and we will cover this in the weeks to follow. If we have 2 bytes for the host portion and 2 bytes for the network, so we have 192.168.1.2 with a subnet mask of 255.255.0.0, we can have 65,534 hosts on that network. If we have our 10 network, we can actually have 16.7 million hosts on that network. So depending on how many bytes we allocate for network and how many bytes we allocate for host tells us how many hosts we can have on a particular network. Why do all your home routers have 255.255.255.0 as their subnet mask? Probably because the manufacturers of your device can envisage no more than 254 devices on your home network.
And I don't think you can have that many.
Yes, you can, actually.
I don't want to.
I thought that most home routers would make you stop at 32.
No, most wireless access points in home routers have an association limit of 32. However, the routers themselves can handle 254 hosts in their network address translation tables. So you'd have to cable them in and daisy chain switches, but it is theoretically possible. So has anybody noticed that if you generally tend to connect machines onto a home router, and we'll just take your bog standard sort of router, the router has an IP address of 192.168.1.1, and you can visit its web page by going to http://192.168.1.1. Has anybody ever noticed that the PCs get allocated 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, 1.5, 1.47, 1.48? Has everybody sort of seen that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I usually see 101, 102, stuff like that. But yeah.
The Linksys allocates starting at 100. The actual default on a Linksys router, even if you are running third-party firmware, is to allocate DHCP addresses between 100 and 200.
That's right, yeah.
This is changeable through the web interface on the DHCP configuration page, if ever you feel motivated to do that. However, the reason they do that by default on the Linksys is that, hey, if you break it and then you fix it, you learn something, though. So basically what happens is the reason they do that is so that you can statically allocate things that are going to be on .2, .3, .4, .10, .20, .30. So if you've got file servers or printers or stuff that you don't want the IP addresses changing on, you can statically allocate them there. And then for your PCs and stuff, they will actually get addresses between 100 and 200, and you don't have to worry about the particular allocation, unless, of course, you are BitTorrenting and your universal plug-and-play is broken, and then you do have to start messing with statically allocating your PC's addresses, and if you were doing that, you would move it down below 100. Which is why, if your DHCP decides that you actually have a different IP address than what you had last time, your Skype port forward will break. Alrighty, does anybody have any questions?
Are we talking about network or subnet or the network classes yet, or not?
Well, I could mention, and if we were doing classful subnetting, you'd be good if it was like 15 years ago, but now we do classless routing. Basically, a Class A network is 255.0.0.0. In other words, you can have 16.7 million addresses on a Class A network. Class B is 255.255.0.0. And Class C is 255.255.255.0. Which is to say that if we convert the number of 255s into Braille, we get A, B, C. That's how you remember it.
Oh, the other thing to remember is that an IP address without a subnet mask is invalid, and it'll never come true in your worst nightmare. They'll always give you that information.
That is exactly right. You always must have an IP address and a subnet mask to know what network your machine is on. Now, interestingly enough, if you look at the RFCs, they actually tell you that addresses between 1 and 127 will default to Class A, which is 255.0.0.0. Addresses from 128 to 191 will default to Class B, 255.255.0.0. And addresses in Class C from 192 to 223 will default to Class C, 255.255.255.0. So if anybody ever wondered why the auto configuration address of 169.254 had to have a subnet mask of 255.255.0.0, that is actually why, because that is the default subnet mask for numbers between 128 and 191. So one of the things that you may be asking yourself is, why would we bother subnetting? And there are actually a number of reasons why you would want to subnet. A lot of them are for security reasons. A lot of them are for policy reasons. A lot of them are for reasons where you need to keep users segregated. Now, say for example, you lived in a shared house and you didn't trust your flatmates. Or you lived in a house where multiple people were using the internet and you wanted to put on bandwidth limits or throttling, or you wanted to restrict certain people from going to certain places. Now, an example of this, for example, depending on certain routers and stuff, say, for example, you had some kids and you didn't want your children looking at pornography on the internet, there are some routers that say can actually put on a filter that says any IP address between 33 and 63, or any IP address between 32 and 64, is not allowed to visit the following level of sites. So it allows you to provide administrative prohibition on certain things so that you can then have, say, for example, the parents' computers able to log on to whatever websites they want, but the kids' websites will be restricted.
Wouldn't another solution for that... Well, never mind.
Go on. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, wouldn't another solution be... Because doesn't OpenDNS have filtering, too?
OpenDNS does have filtering. However, if you are all sitting behind the one public IP address... and you turn on OpenDNS's filtering, it will stop every machine behind the OpenDNS from visiting the porn sites. So nobody can watch porn. Which, whether or not that's a good thing to do or not, I'm not getting into here, that's purely an example. So say, for example, if I want my students who are actually coming into the association to do some work, I actually have the ability to block all of Facebook. And you'd be surprised how much the actual work quotient goes up if you block Facebook.
I'm not coming in anymore.
Oh, come on, you've got some 3G internet, you can sneak around the restrictions. And we haven't blocked Facebook anyway. I think there was actually a survey that said Facebook was one of the most blocked sites in workplaces because people's productivity seriously went down when Facebook was available, because you've got to see that video of those six kittens waking up.
Oh, there's a new kitten video.
Alrighty, and these
Facebook use a lot of bandwidth as well.
Yes, it does. Facebook does use a lot of bandwidth, and YouTube uses a lot of bandwidth. If you think about it, watching a 4 or 5 minute video on YouTube is going to use a lot of bandwidth compared to reading your Cisco notes. Luckily, it hasn't been necessary to institute a block on Facebook and YouTube here, but let me assure you that the infrastructure is just a number of button presses away, and that can happen.
So I'm getting way off base.
Yeah, go ahead,
sorry. Do you configure your... Say, I've got a child and I don't want to go out watching porn. But yet, somebody else in the house does. So I have to configure the child's computer, or is it separately figured through a router?
Okay. If you're using OpenDNS and you've actually got people that need to... some people that need to do something on the network and other people that don't need to do something on the network, because all of your machines appear as though they're coming from behind the same public IP address, you can only configure the blocks as an all or nothing thing. So in that situation, what I would do is I would configure the child's computer to use OpenDNS and I'd put the blocks in place, and I would then not configure the other computers to use OpenDNS so that the child's computer wouldn't be able to go to any of those sites, but the other computers could. Now, obviously, I'm not sure about override password, I haven't looked. I think you can actually lift the restrictions temporarily, but once you lift the restrictions, Grace, you lift them for everyone. But it's still a good idea for OpenDNS, and perhaps you might want to look at OpenDNS for a number of other reasons. OpenDNS will often protect you from not only pornography, but it'll protect you from email scams, phishing sites, invalid banking websites, websites that are trying to steal your personal information. So
the crappy DNS server of your ISP if you don't like it.
Yeah, there are some ISPs that don't have very good DNS servers. And obviously OpenDNS can be a better setup there. So I'd encourage everybody to have a look at OpenDNS. I actually pay for a home premium account. I think it's $5 or $10 a year. And what that allows me to do...
It's $9.95.
You didn't key up until the IVE, so it's $9.95. And what that allows you to do is that allows you to actually, as well as turning on and off... Now you're constantly keyed, I think. One. There we go. So if you actually pay for the $10 a year, it will actually allow you to not only turn on and off particular categories of websites, so you can turn on and off pornography, turn on and off phishing, turn on and off gambling, turn on and off time wasters, yes, that includes Facebook and YouTube, but you can actually whitelist and blacklist specific sites. So if you say, I don't want any gambling, but you do want to go to www.ilovepokermachines.com, you can actually whitelist ilovepokermachines.com and it will actually let you go there. So it's a very good and very powerful security tool that is probably worth a look. It's much more difficult for your children to get around OpenDNS, especially if it's configured on the router, or from your employees. It's much more difficult to get around that than it is to get around something like NetNanny or SurfSafe or one of those other things where the kids have usually figured out how to turn it off anyway the day after you put it on.
Which is why we tell people, don't run as administrator.
Yeah, that's another debate for another time. I think you'd probably also agree, Pranav, that running not as administrator under Windows XP is a very unpleasant experience, especially if you'd like to play any modern game. Windows 7 is significantly better.
Ah, possibly. Yeah.
Microsoft would like to think that you shouldn't be running as an administrator, which is a fair enough thing to assume. However, when you run as administrator, you are unable to install anything. You are unable to do a whole lot of other things, and that includes updating things like browser plugins and stuff, which can be problematic. This has been fixed under Windows 7 to a large degree. It was sort of being fixed under Vista, and they do have all this privilege separation and stuff working far better under 7 than it does under Windows XP. The Mac, as you would well know, has the thing where you put in your password every time you install something, and the Mac is configured so that the first user account that is created on the Mac is given super user privileges. And when you actually key in your password to install something on a Mac, it actually gives the install subsystem super user privilege, so it is able to update system-wide files, which is why it asks you for your password, because it's actually doing a sudo to become the super user to be able to install stuff. I think that was a pretty heavy lecture, and I think we're going to stop around here. Does anybody have any questions, comments on anything to do with exploration or networking in general, or anything they'd like to bring up and raise before I hit stop this week? If you are actually a student of exploration, may I strongly recommend that you go over this lecture, or there's actually a really good one I did 2 years ago, Module 5 Part 3 apparently, that is really, really good. Is that the one, Grace?
It's the supplementals.
Okay, the supplementals I did the year before last apparently were really good, but I was a bit all over the place today because I actually found that I wasn't going to have enough time to get through all of the stuff I needed to get through. So does anybody have anything they want to talk about or discuss before I hit the stop button?
Nope.